Thank you very much, Olga and Marianne, for this wonderful invitation. I immediately, when I read the word plantarium, many associations came to mind. Of course, it seemed to me that what you intended with this is a kind of substitute for herbarium, which is a desiccated collection of plants. And here we are trying, even though it's extremely difficult, to think plants in their living state, as it were, not desiccated, and hopefully our thinking will also rejuvenate upon contact with this non-desiccated object that we are constructing for ourselves. For the talk today, I chose this topic on lack and plenitude in the vegetal world as an organizing theme. It's a very broad theme that will branch out, as you will see, into many different directions, and not only in relation to the vegetal, but in relation to plant-human relations and many other topics that hopefully will be of interest to you today. And I would like to begin with this idea of cornucopia. Whatever the context, abundance is at bottom connotes for us various aspects of the plant kingdom. Why? Perhaps as a consequence of flashbacks in our unconscious to the time when we lived surrounded by vegetal environment rather than the concrete jungles most of us roam in today. A tree in bloom, fertile earth bearing plentiful crops, a basket full of fruit or freshly culled flowers symbolize throughout the different seasons the seemingly inexhaustible giving of the bounty we receive from the world beyond our receptive capacity. So all of these vegetal symbols are become the symbolic of the bountifulness of the natural environment as such. And of course, what happens here is that we turn the actual fruit and flowers and so on into allegories of abundance. Among the mythical symbols of abundance, the one that stands out is cornucopia, also called the horn of plenty or Amalthea's horn. Amalthea was admittedly not a plant, but an animal, a she-goat who suckled Zeus in his infancy while he was hidden from the murderous reach of his father, Cronos. It was her horn that, under mysterious circumstances, broke off from her body and, blessed by the god, bore plenitude. Cornucopia, then, is a hollow animal form filled with the vegetal content that overflows it. Uncontrollable and uncontainable within the rigid limits of an almost inorganic vessel, the yields of cornucopia are pure proliferation, the infinity of finite life that lives above and beyond itself, that reproduces itself without at the same time resorting to the machinations of transcendence. So we have the most iconic image of cornucopia of abundance is this horn of plenty, an animal, a goat horn overflowing with fruit. And I will show you in a little while an image of this by Rubens, and we'll discuss it in a little bit of detail as well. But for now, what I'd like to say is that our relation to the natural environment as such is governed by our unshakable faith in its cornucopia. We think of the world as this infinite factory or infinitely stocked warehouse, which will not be depleted no matter how much we take from it. The giving of vegetal life is converted into its mute and ongoing givenness. You see, the giving of vegetal life, the active giving of plants, is converted by us into its mute and ongoing givenness. We think and act as though our picking, plucking, cutting down, felling, or uprooting of plants does not make a dent in the endless warehouse that the world has become. Heidegger's term for this is a standing reserve. We relate to the world as if it were a standing reserve at our disposal at any moment for whatever we want. Famines, droughts, and other variations on dearth are but local aberrations and temporary disruptions in the cornucopia of a tirelessly laboring nature, the Spinozan natura naturans, nature naturing. Right? This is how we conceive of them. Even when everything is burned to the ground and reduced to ash, the first seeds are ready to sprout. In fact, as we know, ashes are fertilizers for plants. So we know that this kind of very palpable destruction is going to be succeeded by a new growth. Mass extinction is far from our minds at this site, or as we observe the cycles of tenacious rebirth, despite the violence we unleash against life on the planet. The category of renewable energy includes vast crops grown for no other reason than to go up in flames as biomass, from which ethanol will then be distilled. And I put the emphasis on renewable energy, right? It's as if no matter how much we burn, it will the stockpile will always be renewed. And here, in this case, we pat ourselves on the back, on our backs. We congratulate ourselves on coming up with green energy when, in fact, we are burning living plants to convert them into ethanol, as opposed to the long-dead plants that have been converted into coal or oil or natural gas. Amalthea's horn is now a torch passed over to the phoenix. In the Western tradition, physical copiousness, physical abundance, is typically symptomatic of metaphysical lack. And this is the nexus, this is the link I want to explore in detail today. How this physical plenitude, symbolized by plants, connotes metaphysical lack in the Western tradition. The other side of the coin argument, according to which material plenitude masks spiritual paucity, offers a convenient method for philosophy to tame and domesticate abundance. For Plato, for instance, multiple things are chaotic and disorganized unless they are traced back to their original unity in a single idea. Spinoza deems plural phenomena to be distractions from the one substance that envelops everything. At a certain end of metaphysics, Hegel considers the bustling data of sensory experience to be the most abstract and deficient stage initial on the itinerary of spirit. Cornucopia is the enemy of philosophy, which intuits in the anarchic life of plants devoid of an underlying unity the prime example of empirical richness. So in our metaphysical philosophy, as well as in the theological Judeo-Christian tradition, this sort of proliferation of things, this empirical richness, connotes a spiritual lack. The plant is embodied and enacted ideas, substances, spirits, intelligences, and proliferations obstinately resistant to the one, which is to say that the plant does not exist. So when we talk about the plant, the image of the plant, we actually, what we encounter, and this is what I came across in my vegetal philosophy since the very inception, is resistance to the one, resistance to this delimitation that has been the procedure of Western metaphysics since its beginning. Flora is a wellspring of suitable images for material abundance because vegetation is steeped in what we might term an ontological cornucopia, revealing that there is no being behind its becoming, no unified core, center, or common denominator for growing multiplicities. So there is the plant is not one. Every single plant is a multiplicity, which is to say that plants are anarchic, and in this sense, they do not fit this neat image of the philosophical unity that metaphysical thinkers wish to impose onto the world. Psychoanalytically speaking, metaphysical philosophy produces a castrated image of vegetal existence, a stand-in for finite existence in general, as a projection of its own castration anxiety. So if metaphysical reason is this kind of delimited reason within, as Kant says, within its own proper boundaries, then it is this castration of metaphysical thought that produces its split image in the castrated plant that signifies lack. What metaphysics has to say about plants is revealing of something crucial in its own structure. Not so much about plants, but about metaphysics. The lack it presumably spots in the vegetal world when metaphysicians say that plants are mute or that they cannot move or that they're insensitive. All of these deficiencies and lacks are the symptoms of the missing phallus of metaphysics itself, a dearth of the all-powerful unity it is obsessed with. Rather than recognize a gap in itself, such thought transposes it onto the other, who or that can then be depreciated and despised for the failure, which is actually internal to the depreciator, to metaphysical thought itself. For just as there is no the plant, so the one does not exist, the one of metaphysics does not exist, an insight that gives a major blow to metaphysical thought. Fair enough, but what about our economies and their repercussions? Is concrete abundance really a laudable goal? Are we not tired of the ideology of growth and at the economic level and wary of how our world is oversaturated with manufactured things as a consequence? the planet itself is drowning in piles of junk. Plastic packages, styrofoam, undecomposable batteries, gadgets, appliances, clothes, furniture, and so forth, that instantaneously become obsolete so as to satisfy the demand for constant growth. Is that also a cornucopia? Is that how we imitate vegetal abundance at the economic level, right? By producing all of these immediately obsolete things that that actually do not rot, unfortunately. For all the possible parallels between the overwhelming quantities of the fruit of human labor and the actual fruit, the answer to the above questions is no. The products of vegetal growth enrich the soul as they decompose, while those of our industries are more often than not the non-biodegradable contaminants of the environment, nourishing nothing but the increase of capital. That is, in effect, the unmistakable unity between the commodities that surround and suffocate us, namely the implacable law of economic value. More crucially still, the form of value is utterly indifferent to the content of what grows on the poisonous tree of capitalism, be it bombs or designer sunglasses, iPhones or pesticides. Vegetal cornucopia, for its part, is hylomorphic. In philosophy, after Aristotle, we use this term hylomorphism, which means that the form and the content are together in a single unity. Hyle is the Greek word for matter, and morphe is form. And so hylomorphic is the equiprimordiality, the coexistence at the same time of form and matter, meaning that in vegetal cornucopia, plant matter is intimately tied to and equiprimordial with plant forms, unlike in our economies where the form of value is completely indifferent to the matter that is produced all around us. And that is the only sufferable type of abundance, this vegetal abundance, a hylomorphic one, which results neither from the propagation of stuff at the expense of spirit, nor from the deepening of what we call spirit at the expense of the material substratum. There is nonetheless something disconcerting in cornucopia. Its iconic representations, such as Peter Paul Rubens's Abundantia, which you can see here from around 1630, demonstrate the imbrication of animal form and vegetal matter, the fruit spilling over from the rigid shape of the horn. Right? Unable to conceive of plant abundance in its own right, we seek the animal mediation in the hope that it would delimit the vegetal gift. An empty and inflexible horn gives form to, even if, as I have already mentioned, it cannot contain in itself plant giving. Let me try to put my finger on what is most unsettling here, at least for me. The relation between a part of the mythical she-goat and the outpouring of plenty is as indifferent as that between the abstraction of exchange value and the concrete use values of the commodities produced under capitalism's economic regime. So this is the kind of relation between the quasi-inorganic animal shape of the horn and the fruit pouring out of it here. Denied their claim to a form that, for lack of a better term, is self-given, the contents of cornucopia are transformed into biomass and detained in the nightmare of a life that is not theirs. So this is how plants are treated nowadays from the standpoint of the hegemonic capitalist economy and capitalist agro-capitalism as well, as a kind of biomass detained in the nightmare of a life that is not that of the plants themselves. And unless we are completely naive, we would recognize that this is what happens to us humans as well. We are all biomass in the factory of capitalism. So with plants, we share this kind of a predicament in relation to capital. But still, you can see that the horn cannot really contain these alien contents. It cannot contain them for long. The fruit tumble out, their excess over a frame foreign to them, investing cornucopia with meaning. In Rubens's painting, the final moment, the destination or the destiny of cornucopia, is not the release of the fruit from the horn, but the putti, these small semi-human figures at the bottom, who gather them, both catching in midair and picking them up from the ground. Vegetal movement is frozen in the animal form that holds it and the quasi-humans who catch it. Rubens does not quite let the fruit fall. He delivers them to a clasping hand or to the ground. he cannot really deal with the with this gift of vegetal givenness or giving or self-giving that cannot be detained or received fully by us humans. A cornucopia faithful to the vegetal world, on the contrary, valorizes the interval of the free fall, the in-between that diverges from the competing frames imposed on it. After plant hylomorphism, that is the next best thing, in my view. This kind of focusing on the in-between where the fruit have already fallen but have not hit the ground or have not been caught. This movement of the free fall that I identify with existence as such. Next, the next section of my talk is titled Voiceless Speech or Vegetal Logos Without Logos. As we keep exploring these connotations of a lack in the vegetal world that actually stand in for the excess of positivity that we cannot receive, it is important to focus on this idea that plants are mute existences and what actually hides behind this attribution of muteness to plants. One consequence of considering the vegetal world under the aspect of metaphysical lack is the attribution of muteness to plants, overriding the plenitude of their language or languages. The obscure underside of the question, who speaks, is a generally unquestioned assumption that there is something, a what rather than a who, that does not speak. Speech, or more precisely the capacity to speak, confers the right to subjectivity and hence fitness to be counted as a who, not a what. This capacity wrests speaking beings from the world of mere noise or mute existence and bestows upon them the privilege of sense, of making, giving, and receiving sense. And it leaves many others behind in the dim regions of senselessness, of insignificance tied to the presumed absence of self-signifyingness. And this is where plants have been left, this gray area for millennia of kind of senseless existence, at least in the sense in which plants cannot make sense of themselves, but need that extra move of being interpreted or used by animals or humans. Things become a little clearer if we translate the question, who speaks, into yet another language, the vernacular of Western metaphysical tradition. In the context of ancient Greece, of ancient Greek thought, this question asks, who has access to logos? Who has access to logos? For Plato and Aristotle, both a portion of our own psyches and various non-human modes of existence are grouped under the heading of alogon, this alpha privative, the alogon, that is to say, of that which is voiceless, without a voice, shorn of speech, inarticulate, but also irrational, unreasonable, absurd. The polysemy of logos, logos means many things in Greek, one cannot really translate it directly. This polysemic nature of logos is then experienced in terms of its internal fissuring. Humans speak and reason, but can fall into absurdity. Animals have a voice without reason. Plants have neither voice nor reason. Right? This is the framing of the question in classical terms. As a result, tensions and contradictions persist in how logos is allocated among human beings, depending on which criteria are valid for a speech not deemed nonsensical, and among plants, according to their association with the powers of vocalization devoid of reason. When it comes to plants, however, the exclusion appears to be absolute, rather than relative or partial, as in the case of human groupings and animals, preventing plants from latching onto any aspect of logos. In response to this question, who speaks, we say with the utmost assurance, not a plant. Plants do not speak, we think, right? The assertion that plants are voiceless, that they are devoid of logos, is another permutation of the castration anxiety that gives rise to phallogocentrism, or in this case, phytophallogocentrism. But even on the grounds of metaphysical thought, can anything or anyone be maintained, kept in being, without a modicum of articulation, and hence without the gathering activity of logos? Logos is a noun in Greek that derives from the verb legein, which means to gather, to articulate, to bring together. And so for the Greeks, in Greek ontology, nothing could be kept in being unless it was minimally gathered together, articulated. right? And so conceivably, you could say that everything that is in being has a logos because it has been gathered together and can exist in this at least temporary unity. So how can we hear plants speak? What kind of an ear is required so as to listen to their speech bereft of a voice, or at least of one that would be recognizable and familiar to us? These have been some of the most persistent, at once ontological and ethical, preoccupations of my plant thinking. A way of attending to the concerns raised here with regard to vegetal life, one way of attending to these concerns, is to redraw the boundaries of what is called speech. Such an exercise does not envision a growing inclusion of beings previously considered voiceless within the concentric circles surrounding an expanded notion of the voice. Instead, what I'd like to focus on is another meaning of logos, namely articulation, and with its help, hasten a shift away from the contrast between muteness and speech. So I want to translate, I want to bracket for a moment this polysemic, multiple meaning of logos in Greek, and think of it as an articulation, and then taking it in this direction, see what happens exactly. I think that articulation is a beautiful word that does what it says. It articulates, puts together, two disparate regimes, which in Descartes stood for extended and cognitive realities respectively, res extensa and res cogitans. To articulate, at least in English, is to join things in space as well as to render them into words. So articulation has this spatial material and expressive articulate kind of stratum. To articulate is to join things in space as well as to render them into words. To put together and make contiguous as well as to express and vocalize. Its operations destabilize the difference between the ideal and the material, just as for Derrida, a certain type of broken articulation, the hinge, la brisure, disturbed the distinction between speech and writing. In this light, the question who speaks elliptically inquires, who speaks with what? Who articulates by means of a voice? Who resorts to a speech that, though voiceless, is no less articulate and articulated in its reliance on spatial jointures? A plant, for instance, is a specific self-articulation in response to the other, be it sunlight, water, or the other elements it draws together in its acts of living. It speaks by articulating itself in the place of its growth, by developing roots and branches, by producing the open-ended and infinitely replicable multiplicities of so-called modular morphological structures. So the entire process of plant growth is an articulation of multiplicities, which I would like to include under the heading of logos. Not necessarily communicating anything, a plant speaks with and as its body, insofar as it is the very extending of the extended and the cognizing of cognition that gets in touch better, more thoroughly, with the world around as it grows. Vegetal being is nothing but an articulation, and as I've already mentioned, the self-articulation of the extended cognizing thing that we call a plant. And the thing has to be put in brackets here, because the question is, who is it that's speaking? It too contributes to the inevitable fracturing of logos, whence it receives speech without voice, a logos without logos. Far from a deficiency, this is the sine qua non of speaking, this is the absolutely necessary condition of speaking, this fracturing of logos. No finite articulation is in a position to articulate logos, articulation as such, and as a whole. No matter who speaks and with what, we can never really exercise the whole of logos. Logos has to be fractured. Who speaks always limits the range, content, form, tone, rhythm, and modulations of the speaking that ensues. But in the absence of this enabling limitation, there is no speech whatsoever. We should thus not hear in the vegetal logos without logos the deficiency and privation it has been linked to throughout the history of Western thought. The plant's speech without voice is the positive limit of expression, promising to enrich our own sense of articulation and to rescue our theories of signification from their idealist impasse. And so the next section is taking a little bit further this idea of vegetal logos without logos and thinking about what I call L'écriture végétale. L'écriture végétale and the kind of plant writing as another modality of this kind of an articulation that I would like to ask to imagine here today. Could it be that writing, in the ample deconstructive sense of the term, above all in the shape of the Derridean archiwriting, is more welcoming to the vegetal mode of expression than speech? After all, for Derrida, the absent presence of traces in the written medium is more propitious to finite existence than a metaphysical fiction of pure presence attached to speech. Pure presence, channeled through the voice, or more precisely through hearing oneself speak, is a mirror image of pure absence, whereas life, which for Derrida is always a life-death marked by its finitude, unfolds between these two extremes, between pure presence and pure absence, that ultimately amount to one and the same thing, exactly because of their pureness, right? We know that everything that exists is impure in this sense. Only a metaphysical fiction imputes a certain pureness to things, or purity. Especially vegetal life-death, whose logos without logos shows more affinities to writing than to speech, and this is my hypothesis here. More than that, if it is indeed the case that plant thinking drastically changes how we view both plants and ourselves in relation to them, in relation each to her, himself, and to each other, then a qualitatively new mode of writing is required to express such seismic shifts of perspective. For my part, I have not tried deliberately, at least, to cultivate a writing style that, in the footsteps of last century's experiments by philosophers including Hélène Cizou, Julia Kristeva, and Lucy Rigueray with l'écriture féminine, I would like to term l'écriture végétale, so feminine writing, vegetal writing. But the lack of a deliberate plan did not mean that the seeds of vegetal writing remain dormant and have not germinated in something recognizable only in retrospect. In effect, the unconscious manner in which this non-project unfolded was probably more loyal to plants than all the painstaking attempts to emulate their growth in conscious, self-conscious, and representation-bound human thought. So this kind of planlessness in the development of vegetal writing, I claim, is probably more faithful to the way plant writing proceeds by the plants themselves. The rapid extension of my initial project from Plant Thinking, published in 2013, took me by surprise. I often joke that my philosophy of vegetal life itself grew like a plant, tending in all directions at once, toward the sciences and the arts, ethics and politics, intellectual biography and autobiography. There is more than a grain of truth in this statement. The content, form, and method of plant thinking cannot be easily parsed out into its independent components. It's how, where, and when influencing the what. Plant thinking is extremely contextually bound, just as Olga mentioned, the feminist thinking has been now for decades. Its life and its text are as much about the milieu and the context as they are about whatever is conveyed by means of the formal expression all too swiftly inserted into a venerable lineage of critical and academic discourses. So the text and the context, especially in relation to plants, are one and the same. Exactly because plants are not entirely separate from the milieu where they grow, right? That kind of individuation that we associate with the separation from a place where we are, from our environment, is not at all in place insofar as plants are concerned. And this is something we humans could learn from them as well, right? This kind of contextual living, living in contiguity and continuity with a place of growth, is something that plants are practicing, something that their lives depend upon, because they simply can, as rooted in a place, they cannot leave that place behind, unlike us humans. And so the text and the context of growth are one and the same for plants, and that should be the case also for plant thinking and plant writing, if not for another mode of human living that would be more in tune with our environment as well. I started with a theoretical exploration of the place of plants in metaphysics, in plant thinking, and of the role they could play in the post-metaphysical transition. From there, I embarked on a journey through the fields, groves, forests, and gardens of philosophy, seeking guidance for an alternative reading of the tradition and of certain philosophical biographies, from the vegetation that proliferated in the canon's blind spots. The results of this exercise are gathered in the philosopher's plant. Soon thereafter, together with Lucy Rigaray, I delved into a collaborative, what we would like to call, both Lucy and I call, auto-hetero-phytobiography, the sharing of a life or of lives among the co-authors, the readers, and plants themselves. And thus, through vegetal being, two philosophical perspectives was born and was came out last year. Another collaborative attempt, this time with a French artist, Anaïs Tondeur, sifted through autobiographic, aesthetic, historical, and phytological prisms, and also came to fruition last year in the Chernobyl Herbarium. And finally, the collection Grafts appeared, as I say in the preface to that book, it appeared in the in-between space where previously unimagined forms of thinking eventually come to life, thanks to the interventions, interactions, interpretations, and interviews focused on the thinking of, but also proper to, plants. About, but also proper to, plants. So a definite pattern emerges here. Why am I narrating this very schematically? A definite pattern emerges here in this path which is unplanned, which unfolded spontaneously, moving from the universal to the singular, right? And plant thinking is a kind of deconstruction of the metaphysical tradition, reimagining a post-metaphysical transition, then rereading the tradition through intellectual biographies of its various authors, then moving closer to auto-hetero-phytobiography and a certain singular experience, even more so with Chernobyl, right? So there is a definite pattern of moving from the universal to the singular, and in an immediate reflux back again from a more or less solitary work to thinking with and growing with others, human or not. But the loose pattern is not the same thing as a method, itself a way which is universally prescribed or at least universalizable, and therefore valid to the extent that it lends itself to being trodden by many feet over and over again. So if I'm correct in teasing out from my itinerary a tendency toward the singular that intersects with but is not dissolved in the universal, then the path I've taken thus far is an anti-method. And plant thinking, perhaps, plant thinking and plant writing have to be an anti-method, which on its own terms prohibits any following after, though you are absolutely free to let the above prohibition fall on deaf ears, of course. Right? In the ambiguous interplay of its singular and universal moments, in its exemplary non-exemplariness, I discern the outlines of l'écriture végétale that replicates the singular universality of the plants themselves. What do I mean by the singular universality of plants? While plants are parts of a natural world, however manipulated by humans and molded by humans, and the natural world, nature in Greek, is physis, which for them doesn't mean a collection of living beings, but means the overall growth of everything, emergence, coming to appearance, or coming out of itself. While plants are a part of nature as physis, they embody in all their singularity the universality of nature. They are phytoi, growing beings, right? So plants are these singular aspects of the universal that in their singularity embody the universal of nature. While l'écriture végétale departs from and circles back to the vegetal, it sweeps the entire world into its midst, not sparing us, ourselves, either. I'm not going to dwell at length on the convergences and divergences between l'écriture féminine and l'écriture végétale, but a few words are in order on this on this comparison, which deserves much more care and attention than I can devote to it here today. One thing ought to be mentioned. Both kinds of writing invite misinterpretation based on what amounts to the seduction of classification. And Marianne has noted that we're not so far from the place where botanical classifications were born as well. And the seduction of classification is still very strong, and it's especially dangerous in the case of these two kinds of writing. It is assumed that the feminine or the vegetal are classes of beings like any other, that is to say, discrete kinds or immaterial boxes within which women and plants respectively belong, right? This is what we assume when we work with classifications, that classes of things or of beings are these immaterial boxes, these containers, invisible containers, within which certain beings fit, right? And so we think that the feminine is where a box where women fit, and the vegetal is a box where plants fit. Yet nothing is further from the truth than this kind of an assertion. Not only do vegetal and feminine ontologies embrace unfathomably more than the ontic realities of plants and women, but they are in themselves plastic enough to accommodate their other, the human, the masculine, who has traditionally denigrated and abused them. In their singularity, l'écriture féminine and l'écriture végétale gesture toward universality. But why direct our attention to writing? Could it be that this medium most effectively challenges and subverts the silence to which Western logos once submitted the feminine and vegetal alike, and often the one as the other? Note that I'm not saying or writing, which is what I did as when I prepared these remarks, that the experimental modes of expression discussed in my talk and in my work break the silence imposed on certain living beings as a curse or a prison. It is not a question of breaking the silence, which is another kind of temptation, in addition to this temptation or seduction of classification. Instead, these modes of expression dispense with a deafening noise of logos and put their hopes in the voiceless supplement of speech, namely writing, which, according to Derrida, comes first. The supplement comes before that which it supplements. Slipping below the incessant talk show, and I hear this term with a literal as well as a phenomenological ear, the incessant talk show that speech is or has become in our so-called age of communication, l'écriture féminine and l'écriture végétale touch upon something of archiwriting, the practice of tracing and inscribing inseparable from existence as such. That they do so is testimony to the fact that neither of them is easily classifiable, and so is not detainable within the empirical confines of a writing style, let alone of an identity politics, everywhere seeking the voices of those who seem to represent previously oppressed groups. So this question of the voice has to be problematized, I think. This idea of breaking the silence has to be problematized, and I'm building a very preliminary analogy here between the two kinds of writing that I'm teasing out. L'écriture végétale is further distinguished by two imperfectly overlapping frames, their edges unaligned with one another. On the one hand, the writing or archiwriting of plants and of the vegetal aspects in creatures normally not classified as plants, including us humans. On the other, the writing about vegetal archiwriting, retracing its traces, or letting those traces come to the fore, finally liberated from a long history of their erasure. The gap between the two frames, the writing of the plants themselves and the writing about plants, the gap between the two frames is far from a debilitating condition. On the contrary, it opens the breathing space that guarantees some measure of autonomy to plants, even as it foments our intimate relation to them. Supplemented by plant writing, and the supplement, as we know, always comes first, plant thinking operates within the enabling limits of this double framing that determines, both removes the term and imposes the term, determines it without imposing the suffocating closure of classificatory thought. And the final section of my talk on plant stimulation and all of those stimulants that accompany us in everyday life, the first cup of coffee in the morning, but also, which hopefully we all got just before this talk, but also what I'm most interested in is the idea that plants are stimulants beyond these few species that we have harnessed and cultivated in order to garner more energy for ourselves, right? So I want to problematize this very idea of stimulation also in relation to the gender binaries that it often connotes and of course in relation to the vegetal world. So there's yet another way in which plants allow us to experience plenitude, not only at the level of our senses, but also insofar as thinking is concerned. I'm referring to the interaction of plants with our nervous system that earns them the name stimulants. So we think that plants are brainless, they are dumb, and so on, and yet we resort to certain species of plants in order to think better or more sharply or to awaken our senses and our thinking, right? And so they interact with our nervous system and become stimulants. As I see it, not only tobacco leaves and coffee beans belong to this group, but also every vegetal species, from mosses and grasses to rose bushes and olive trees. Often unbeknownst to us, plants stimulate us by giving a vibrant world of smells, colors, shapes, and tastes to our senses. Above all, they undergird abstract ideation traceable back to the most material and concrete strata of digestion and sexuality that are involved in the vegetal soul, the Aristotelian totrepticon, which enables my reproduction and renewal, be it in myself or in the other. And this is the material basis for thinking, is this plant thinking divided into the digestive and sexual capacities of the totrepticon, not only in Aristotle, but then modified throughout the history of philosophy. You find intimations of this in Nietzsche and Freud, even though they do not really refer to plants necessarily. Now, this basis remains hidden and withdrawn unless it prickles, jolts, or goads us on in an intense way. So usually we don't notice that our thinking is vegetally based unless there are certain plants that somehow jolt us out of our torpor and actually make us more alive, experience the world more intensely. The spiritually or mentally jolting, prickling, goading plants are stimulants properly so-called, because of the effect they have on the central nervous system. Theirs, however, is the extreme case on the broad continuum of cognitive and behavioral influences the vegetal world exerts on us. So I don't want to privilege just these classical stimulants, but I want to think about plants as stimulants as a way of dispensing to them their own subjectivity, their own agency, as it were, which we have misrecognized and have not acknowledged enough. Consider, for instance, soybeans. Hardly classifiable as stimulants, they can have a profound impact on human hormonal and reproductive systems, thanks to the release of phytoestrogens, which are akin to the sex hormones, of course, that we know in the human world. MicroRNAs from rice, usually regulating plant development, survive the digestion process in our bodies, persist in mammalian tissues, and manipulate the expression of animal and human genes, such as those responsible for prompting receptors in the liver to filter out LDL, or bad cholesterol. Concentrated glucose from overcooked starchy vegetables played a crucial role in the evolution of the growing brain with its increased metabolic demands. Right? So all of these three examples are ways in which plants, usually not considered stimulants, have stimulated something that we think of as typically human. In each case, consumed plants stimulate a physiological or evolutionary process or function in their human consumers. Far from fuel that passes without a trace through the body machine it powers, plant matter interacts with and indeed acts upon the non-vegetal organism that receives it. So we tend in our mechanistic sort of view of the world and of our bodies, we tend to think of our bodies as machines that are fueled by food, right, and by drink. But this is not the case at all. So digestion is a kind of interaction. We, of course, act upon that which we eat, but that which we eat also acts upon us. We are acted upon. We are, in a sense, passive with respect to the plants that we consume. And that is not the case at all in fuel that that passes through that powers a machine. Assuming that the Cartesian mind-body dualism is misguided, as we've already seen in relation to articulation, the same vegetal interaction with and action upon human thinking should be expected as the one we experience in our corporeality. So just as our bodies are acted upon by the plants we consume, so our minds, our thinking, have to be also acted upon by plants. Because otherwise, if we say that our bodies are influenced but not our minds, we again subscribe to the old Cartesian dualism, right? Much of my energy that went into formulating plant thinking derives from this hypothesis. As for herbal stimulants per se, they reveal the absurdity of equating plants with passivity, torpor, slowness, and deficiency, which has been traditionally the case. It is to certain beans and leaves that we turn when we want to quicken our heart rates, accelerate our metabolisms, or encourage the rapid firing of neuronal synapses. We might feel sluggish and devoid of energy before that first cup of daily coffee that makes the world come into focus. In this sense, plant-derived stimulants restore the forgotten semantic dimension of the words vegetal and vegetation, that instead of referring to the unconscious condition of the persistent vegetative state, to this absolute passivity, are associated with vigor and even virility, right? So the semantic root of the vegetal and the vegetative is vigor and virility, right? Stimulants masculinize the otherwise feminized flora, imbuing it with the sense and connotations of power and potency. Having emerged as a medical term in the end of the 17th century, stimulant originally meant, and I quote from the dictionary of the time, something that goads a lazy organ, most frequently the penis, right? So this is what stimulants were originally. They were completely masculinized things that presumably restored potency, sexual potency to men. The gender-related polarization of plants between the vast majority of species that are feminized and the masculinized stimulants is nonetheless undesirable and injurious both to the environment and to ourselves. That is one of the reasons why I want to think of all the plants as stimulants and not just this special group of the masculinized ones. The exceptions of coffee, cacao, tobacco, coca, and so on merely prove the general rule that attributes to vegetation as a whole a passive role, while consigning to oblivion the gradual and sustained stimulation it provides for our bodies and thinking alike. According to Russian philosopher Vladimir Bibikin, they, the stimulants, represent the revenge of the forest. This is how he puts it, the revenge of the forest against which our civilizations have fought since their very inception. So if the civilizing mission is to cut down the forest, to clear it, at least in those parts of Central and Eastern Europe, in Germany, Central Europe and Russia, where the forest is the first environment and within which a space for life has to be carved out by clearing the forest, right? This particular philosopher, Vladimir Bibikin, thinks that there is the revenge of the forest, almost like the return of the repressed. You cut it down, but it comes back, and often in sublimated forms, such as the stimulants, the revenge of the forest within us, right? The revenge of the forest against which our civilizations have fought since their very inception. The seductive, decivilizing forces of stimulants that undo the thin varnish of reason smeared on the human subject are nothing other than the return of the vegetal repressed. But the rhetoric of revenge, with its aggressive, militaristic, and vindictive insinuations, contributes to a masculinized view of those plants that do not go quietly into the green night to which we consign them. Furthermore, stimulants are caught up in a vicious cycle with our highly ruinous conception of energy, which knows no active rest, no end, and no fulfillment. So just as the cycle of capital has to reinitiate over and over again, not letting anyone or anything rest, so our bodies put in the service of this kind of an energy are supposedly fueled by vegetal stimulants to be in the service of capital. The stimulants then substantiate this conception, even as the energy of pure potentiality demands their increased use. Capitalist production, which is increasingly a production of needs, lifestyles, and desires, plugs into the circuit of stimulants and energy as potentiality, which explains the glowing success of corporations such as Starbucks or previously the tobacco companies. To be sure, the use of cocoa or tobacco leaves, among others, pre-exists capital and is widespread among the traditional societies of Latin America, for example. But there is something in the logic of herbal stimulants that capitalist production binds its apparatus to and exaggerates. I'm thinking about excess. I'm thinking about an excess that this other plenitude that is gathered into vegetal stimulation. Unlike other plant products, stimulants do not cater to the immediate physiological requirements for nourishment. They first satisfy human desires as opposed to needs. Even if following habituation and addiction, the desire in all its superfluity may become a need in its own right. Similarly, capital consists not so much in the value drawn from the utility of commodities, nor in their immediate exchange value, but in surplus value, over and above the material sphere of production. A surplus value capital is the excess of what is not restituted back to the workers in the form of wage labor, right? The basics of Marxism. The increase in margins of profit depend on the expansion of this excess, which in the absence of state interference is the stimulus of economic growth, itself a vegetal term automatically applied to the economy. We want the economy is to grow, right, without really thinking what growth means and how it derives from the plant world. By analogy with herbal stimulants, surplus value bestows virility, potency, or power onto those who appropriate it, without any inherent actual end in sight. And, again akin to addictive stimulants, this power can never stagnate if it is to live up to its dynamics. Rates of growth are themselves supposed to grow quarter after quarter, year after year, for the economy to be deemed healthy. You cannot even have a stable rate of growth. The rate of growth itself needs to grow for an economy to be deemed healthy. We would not find it strange that the defenders of excess who rebel against the classical virtue of moderation would adhere to a romanticized view of the stimulants, of vegetal stimulants. 10th century Persian-born philosopher Avicenna, who liked to experiment with plants for medical purposes and who died of a celery seed overdose, famously preferred to measure the days and the nights of his life in breadth rather than length. That is to say, in the intensity of lived time instead of its extensiveness. Intensive living is an effect quite distinct from the empty excesses binding together the spiral of addiction and the treadmill of capital. When stimulants are put in the service of a life that is full and perhaps overflowing with itself, however, then they are neither pure means without an end nor transcendent ends divorced from the finitude and fragility of our world. A question arises. What does such ethical stimulation actually entail, such ethical stimulation which allows the life to overflow with itself as opposed to be put in the service of capital? Lest we lose sight of another etymological stratum of the word, the origin of the Latin stimulus is itself vegetal. It evokes a sharp and pointed stick, a prickle, or a sting, in any event a defensive part or a reaction initiated by a plant. To stimulate is to prickle, that's why it's a kind of goading, right? Goading on. A stimulus always calls for a response, whether conscious or not. When stimulated, we respond. Accepting that every plant is a stimulant with respect to our bodies and minds, we are urged by it to respond, and especially to assume responsibility, which is an ongoing ethical task. And this is what this other kind of vegetal stimulation I want to imagine, this is what it provokes. It is a stimulus, an ethical stimulus that invites an ethical and ontological response from us. The ends of this responsibility are folded into responsiveness itself, not imposed from the outside, but imminently arising from our encounters with the vegetal world, from the sting or the prickle our consciousness and our conscience might experience upon contact with plants. True, the familiar herbal stimulants containing caffeine, ephedrine, and other substances goad us on to engage with and respond to countless things that do not belong to the context of such encounters. Still, in these exceptional instances, stimulation is doubled, and the excitement of our sensorium and of our cognition overlays the more stable stimuli we receive from plants that at all times demand a response. And I think one of the failures of the metaphysical tradition, of the Western tradition in its relation to plants, is exactly its unresponsiveness to them. It's exactly its ontological and ethical unresponsiveness. And that is what I have in mind when I say that plants have been confined to the blind spot of metaphysics, or to this undifferentiated green night of metaphysics. The entwined ethico-ontological nature of my plant thinking has been precisely this. It has put forth an archaeology of primary vegetal stimulation repressed in the subsequent transactions with the world around us. If powerful stimulants can clearly illustrate the active role of plants vis-a-vis human subjects, can, in other words, illustrate what we call plant agency, then so be it. But we should never forget that the sporadic stimulation they yield is only an exaggerated version of a calmer, steadier, and gentler goading of the human by our vegetal others. Thank you for your attention.